following podcast contains bold ideas, unique perspectives, and strong opinions that may be disturbing to those suffering from closed-mindedness. Listener discretion is not advised. Welcome to Non Sequitur, Season 1, Episode 1. Genesis, in the beginning there was a debate on evolution versus creation between evangelist Kent Hovind and biologist Dr. Herman Mays. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Wait, hang on. Do you want to talk about it for the show or just now?
Oh no, we're live. It's too late. I've already let the cat out of the bag. We have to talk about it now.
What are we talking about?
The biggest issue facing America today.
Please, you know what this is, right? Tell me. No, I'm curious now.
National Whatever Day.
Whatever what?
You insert any stupid word you want and it'll work.
National Potato Day.
There is a National Potato Day.
There is not no National Potato Day.
There is a National Potato Day.
Get out.
Listen, Steve.
Don't make me Google this stuff.
No, please Google it.
No, I don't want to Google National. Do you think I want that in my search history? That somebody can go look and see that I Googled National Potato Day?
This is like, listen, okay. Let's go over what today is first. Let's just start there. Today, on January the 16th, 2018... There are actually four things today. Four things get one day, all right? See if you can follow this. Today is National Nothing Day.
Why are we celebrating nothing?
We're going to get there. Today is also National... I feel stupid. Today is National Without a Scalpel Day.
Okay.
You want to take a...
I don't have a scalpel. I've never had a scalpel. So well, I have to celebrate that.
You're prepared for that.
Then. I'm already way ahead of the curve on that one then, yeah. I'll today let people know national, we're having a party for that.
Today is National Fig Newton Day.
I don't eat Fig Newtons. You know why I don't eat Fig Newtons? This is the truth. It's going to sound...
It scares me that you have a story behind
there,
why
there
you
is
don't
a story.
Eat Fig Newtons.
I'm not exaggerating. I don't eat Fig Newtons after I found out how many bug parts actually go into it. I know that sounds bad, but I don't like...
Oh, that's an old wives'
tale.
No,
it's not an old wives' tale. That is absolutely the case, that there are so many bug parts in Fig Newtons. It's for the way they process it. Now, I understand it's a psychological thing, but I don't know. And they're not that good enough to me to overcome that fear, I guess.
You're doing exactly what they want you to do, Steve. They don't want you to pay attention to National Whatever Day. And so you're going off on a totally different direction.
They want me to ignore the National Scalpel Day or the National Nothing Day?
Because with those three things... Those three issues. There is also today being celebrated National Religious Freedom Day.
Well, I'm okay with that day, I think. I mean,
yeah. I would agree. Yeah, but okay, please tell me how you connect National Religious Freedom Day with National Fig Newton Day, with National Without a Scalpel Day, with National Nothing Day.
Because maybe you're a philosopher talking about existential crisis during surgery while having a hunger attack.
I'm over this podcast.
We're done.
Okay, but let's go into just a little bit. Just a little bit. We have to. What is National Nothing Day? You ask. Well, each year on January the 16th, people across the nation observe National Nothing Day. No, they do not. No, they do not. No one that I know of with a brain celebrates National Nothing Day. There's nothing to celebrate.
Yeah, in all my years, I've never had a party that I went to that was celebrating National Nothing Day, ever.
But they continue. National Nothing Day was created as a day to provide Americans with one national day when they can just sit without celebrating, observing, or honoring anything. But they follow it up with Without a Scalpel Day. And isn't it defeating the purpose that you declare a day to celebrate nothing so that you can celebrate nothing?
But if you have a day for like celebrating without a scalpel, shouldn't you have equal opportunity and have a day to celebrate those with scalpels? Or is it just
there's
for the
not enough days, Steve?
Well, you know what? We need more days of the year then. Because, I mean, that's kind of, you know, oppressing the people that do have scalpels. It's like making them feel insignificant in society because they own a scalpel and somebody else are scalpel deficient.
But they have it. Listen, they have an interesting caveat here. It says Martin Luther King Day falls on the third Monday of January, which means that one in seven January the 16th will fall on the same day as National Do Nothing Day, effectively nullifying the nature of National Nothing Day.
If you do something on National Nothing Day, aren't you kind of violating the spirit of nothingness? Now, again, are we talking about scientific nothing, like, you know, like quantum fluctuations and instabilities? Are we talking about philosophical existential nothing where there's this nothing? It could be either, I guess, right? I guess it could be
the fact that you even applied
something to it makes it something. Yeah.
National without a scalpel day, right? No surgery, no stitches, no scars. We observe National without a scalpel day each year on the 16th. The first angioplasty, a groundbreaking procedure to open a blocked blood vessel, was performed on this day in 1964.
So it's dealing with people. Okay. Wait, let me get. So it's dealing with people. It's dealing with not having to use scalpels for surgery, not the possession or lack of possession of having a scalpel.
I am so confused.
Because now I really want a scalpel, and that makes me sound psychotic.
I guess because it says this is where doctors treat disease through a tiny pinhole instead of open surgery.
Laparoscopic surgery.
I guess it's to celebrate the fact that you don't have scores. Okay, well, I can see that. But the fact that you put it on National Do Nothing Day is...
It seems to be a conflict there.
Okay, look, we've only got two more to get through. And then we have...
I don't know if I can take two more.
We have Kent Hovind and Dr. Richard Mays.
They might have to wait, though. I don't know. This seems to be kind of interesting at the moment. But we'll get to them. We'll get to them. Hang on there, guys. We'll get to you guys.
National Fig Newton Day. Okay. I'm not even going to read anything about that because the last of the Fig Newtons were made in 1964, right? All the Fig Newtons that we have today are still left over from 1964.
So they're kind of like Twinkies.
No one likes Fig Newtons. I know of no one that eats Fig Newtons. I think I would find that really weird if I saw somebody eating a fig. Think about this, Steve. When's the last time that you've seen anyone eating a Fig Newton?
Oh, I don't want to go out of my way to look for people that eat Fig Newtons, and I don't eat them myself. But it's kind of like Twinkies. Twinkies, I think, didn't they get, like, not produced anymore? And, like, all that was left are just been carried over from decades of manufacturing of Twinkies? Because they have a half-life of, like, a million years. They don't biodegrade or anything.
But I don't know if I would put Twinkies and Fig Newtons in the same...
Yeah, one has less insect parts. So I'll eat the Twinkies.
Moving on. National Religious Freedom Day. Now, here's something that I can get behind. The following is as stated by President Barack Obama in his Religious Freedom Day presidential proclamation. I call on all Americans to commensurate this day with events and activities that teach us about this critical foundation of our nation's liberty and show us that we can protect it for future generations here and around the world. Now, as I am not a religious person and I don't, I'm not a fellow believer, I can still appreciate the fact that everyone here is able to believe or not believe as they see fit. So, although I do not prescribe to said religion, I can still get behind the freedom that we have to celebrate it if we wish.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, obviously, I'm not a quote believer either. I'm agnostic, which not theist, not atheist, just absolutely agnostic.
Like a rock.
I am like the definitive agnostic. Whatever it is, I'm agnostic. So yeah, but I do believe that people should have religious freedoms to believe what they want, as long as those freedoms do not interfere with secular society in such a way that you're imposing your personal ideological beliefs upon other people, especially in the school system, which actually kind of relates to what we're going to be talking about tonight. I was getting ready to say, yeah, I know you're way ahead of me on that one.
If this doesn't set the stage for what I think will be quite an interesting conversation, because we have two individuals with completely different perspectives and ideologies it always, to me, I get awestruck sometimes at the ability for there to be like such stark differences between two individuals, but we all have the same data. You know what I mean? Like, we're all looking at the same.
I think we look at it through different filters because people have preconceptions and people do have presuppositions, which is fine. I think it's absolutely normal to have presuppositions. That does not mean that you're presuppositionist for presuppositional argumentation or apologetics. It's just that everybody has these things that they take axiomatically. Not a problem with that. But I think that when they look at the data, like when we look at the evidence for evolution, Kent's going to look at it from his ideological viewpoint that the Bible, the seven-day literal creation of Genesis in Genesis, is the foundation. Nothing can change that. He already has made up his mind that that preconception is an absolute fact, and no amount of science can change that. Well, Dr. Mays is basically looking at the evidence and going, okay, is this conforming to what I know with other branches of science? Is this something we can support with other branches of science? Is it falsifiable? Is it evidential? And that's, I think,
I guess that's
they arrive at two different conclusions that way.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I have sort of a grudge against a particular aspect of that argument. It's that they go into it saying there's nothing that can change my mind. You know what I mean? Like it's
they make that very obvious and clear. They don't even mess around with that. They'll tell you. Well, I know maybe so much about Kent, but other creations I've dealt with will actually say there's nothing that can change my mind on it. And I'm just the complete opposite. I'm like, you show me enough evidence and I will definitely change my position. Because you have to go, you have to change your beliefs in according what you find out to be true about reality.
And I think that's probably the genius that is, in my opinion, religion. The ability that everything is as it says in the book, and by questioning that, the very act of asking questions is considered to be disloyal and unfaithful. And I think that's probably the biggest downfall, I guess you would say, to mankind, I think, because that hinders a lot of people that otherwise are creative and inquisitive from asking those questions. And I think it kind of, you know, it kind of cuts them short, I think.
Yeah, it goes from a position you're not supposed to have doubt. You know, the whole Dan Thomas thing, but I don't think all religions follow that, but it is a great marketing ploy for those who want to keep people in a specific group and under the same fold, you know, and say, oh, you have to believe like this. If not, you're the unbeliever. We will shun you or things of that nature. So it does lend them to say to them, hey, don't doubt this. You can't doubt this. We cannot be wrong. And if that's the case, then basically all of science is what's wrong, not the religion. And so that's why you see so many creationists now out there saying, oh, the science must be wrong, regardless if the science is wrong or not. Most of them don't have the prerequisite knowledge to even make that determination. But they've already decided a priori that the science is already wrong.
Speaking of hilarious jokes, let's talk about what we have coming up on Wednesday's episode. Wednesday, we are going to be talking about the creative process of jokes. And what I mean by that is when a comedian has an idea, be it funny, be it serious, something they see, something they read, we're going to go through what it takes to get that thought from just poof in their head to laughter in the audience. And to do that, we have a very funny stand-up comedian, Tony Deo. He's been featured on Conan O'Brien, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, extremely, extremely methodical comedian. He takes his work very seriously. He's going to be coming on to go through that with us. And also, we will be joined by Steve Lesser. Steve Lesser is the executive producer of the North Carolina Comedy Festival coming up in February. He'll be talking to us about that and some of the big stars that they have coming to the stage this year. Also, we will be joined by another very funny stand-up comedian, Tom Keller, as a guest co-host. So I think it's going to be a really good time, and you should join us. Absolutely join us. You will laugh. You will probably cry in that order. So it should be a good time.
I'm looking forward to that, too. I mean, in fact, the best jokes is when you laugh and cry simultaneously. That's when you know something's funny.
I actually do that every time that we have a conversation.
You know what? I'm in the same boat. Let's do it now. Let's just cry and laugh hysterically for a while until we start the debate.
Well, I think that by the end of the night, at least one of these guys are going to be crying. Steve, why don't you introduce our guest and let's get this thing going?
Absolutely. Today's guests are Dr. Herman Mays and Ken Hovind. Dr. Herman Mays has a PhD in evolutionary biology from University of Kentucky, a bachelor's of science in biology and anthropology also from the University of Kentucky. He is an assistant professor of the biological science department at Marshall University and a former curator of zoology for the Cincinnati Museum Center with a substantial number of prior other adjunct professor positions. Ken Hovind is a young earth creationist who has written a number of seminars on creationism science and holds to a literal account of Genesis and that the earth is approximately 7,000 years old. How are you guys doing today?
Yes, sir. That's good to be here.
So what we're going to do tonight, you guys have kind of wanted to have a slide presentation on the discussion of common ancestry and various models and how it relates to evolutionary biology. What we kind of decided prior to this was you each would have about 15 minutes to do a little slide presentation, and then Kent, you're on your slides, you specifically addressed questions that were given to you prior to this by Dr. Mays. I have a copy of those questions as well, and then you will be, you would, as you go through them one by one, kind of be asked those to go over them with each other. Is that kind of fine in a more of a back and forth, freestyle, organic conversation?
So, I am an evolutionary biologist, and just a little bit about me and my interest. I've always been fascinated by nature and especially animals, and my goal in my career has been to learn more about the natural world through science. And over the years, I've studied birds, and I have students in my lab studying amphibians, and we've recently done a project on the Sumatran rhinoceros. My field work has taken me to Taiwan and mainland China, Hawaii, Ecuador, throughout the continental United States. And I really love what I do, and I do it to learn things about nature, and I love sharing that, what I learned with other people. So is common ancestry an idea that's supported by science? Well, common ancestry is a scientific model, and models make predictions of the data. So we test hypotheses about evolutionary relationships based on these models. Common ancestry is a model. It makes predictions, and we seek to see if those predictions of the model match what we actually observe in nature. Now, Kent Hovind says they just write the name and draw lines between them, and this line becomes their evidence. And then he says they compare the sequence of these letters, meaning letters in DNA. You can look at the similarity of how many base pairs are there, or you can look at simply how many chromosomes they have, meaning the organisms under in question, the total number of chromosomes, or we can look at the estimated gene count. So they're picking one that they want that matches their stupid theory the best. And then he says, if evolution is true, it seems logical, the more chromosomes we have, the more evolved. Two models that we have here. Common design, you might be able to invoke a common design thing, but you would expect that common design would place the whale, the shark, and the manatee on the same branch because they're all designed for the same lifestyle. They live in water. Whereas common ancestry might not place animals with similar lifestyles on the same branch necessarily because they can have different common ancestors. That common design tree is not what we see in the data, and we do see a common ancestry data there. So I'll end there and I'll let Kent take over.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here tonight. My name is Kent Hovind. I taught high school science and math 15 years. Since 1989 or 90, have been traveling speaking on the topic of creation versus evolution. And I take the position that the Bible is literally true and scientifically accurate. The earth is about 6,000 years old and God made all of the animals to bring forth after their kind. Now, what exactly a kind is, I think, is pretty obvious in most cases to a five-year-old. There may be a few tough ones, but a dog and a wolf are the same kind. A dog and a canary are not the same kind. So I take the position there is absolutely zero evidence for any evolution taking place above the level of kind. Now, that may be the same as species in some instances. It might be more like genus or family in other instances. I don't know. So it's an honor to be here defending the biblical view. Drawing lines between these creatures means nothing. It's a line on a piece of paper. It's not evidence. And I talked about Louis L'Amour's books, and I read a lot of them, nearly 100 of them. And I love reading Louis L'Amour. And I noticed in his books that all of them have involved horses. All of them have guns. All have good guys and bad guys. All of them involve good versus evil. All use the same 26 letters. All avoid profanity and all involve women and all have a shootout. So what does that prove? This is exactly what I heard Herman do for the first 20 minutes of his presentation is show all the similarities in the codons and everything and come to the wrong conclusion. I think we could see they all have the same author. So how are these consistently nested hierarchical patterns explained? The same author. And everything that he gave for evidence on his slides, I think, could easily be explained by the same author designed the code. The creatures face similar environmental pressures. They need oxygen. They need a way to process oxygen or carbon dioxide if it's a plant. So yes, of course, there are similarities in the code to create these. So how are the consistent nested hierarchical patterns of neutral variation across different genes explained? The same designer wrote them. That's all. Does common designer hypothesis predict the species living in the same environment and occupying the same ecological niche should be the same? Well, I noticed in my research that snow tires used all over the world have deeper grooves and further apart, even used on trucks. Anything driven in a snowy area, the tires designed for that seem to have deeper and wider tread grooves. Even four-wheelers and off-road vehicles have this. This is proof that it's a good design to use in that environment. So if we have similarities between the whales as far as a fat layer on our body or ability to process foods, that is not evidence of a common ancestor. Does a common design pattern of tires support the hypothesis that vehicles operating in the same environment, I just reworded his question, and occupying the same ecological niche should be the same? No, they're meeting a common need. They face the same hazards and the same similar needs. They need to drive on a slippery surface, so they tires designed for that. So I think the DNA code, all we've ever observed in all of human history is whales producing whales and manatees producing manatees. Now, if he wants to believe, or anybody else wants to believe, that whales and manatees are related, or humans and manatees are related, or anything's related to a manatee, that is fine. You can believe that if you want, but it's not science. It is a religion. It's SpongeBob imagination stuff. Even if it's true, it's not science at that point. Because science deals with things we can study and prove and test and demonstrate. All we've ever seen is manatees produce manatees. There are no exceptions to that. So what specific predictions does special creationism make for comparative molecular genetic data? Well, they're really good. The evolutionists are really good at drawing lines on the piece of paper, showing a human and a monkey and a mouse and a chicken and frog and lampy are related. Well, that's fine. You can draw any lines you want, but that's not science. All that's ever been observed in all of recorded history is a mouse will produce a mouse. Now, if you want to believe a mouse and a chicken are related because of the number of amino acids that differ, that's, again, SpongeBob imagination stuff. That's not science. It's a line on a piece of paper. Here are some lines of code, just randomly selected off the internet. Computer code. Okay, here's some more lines of code. If I looked at the lines of code to do Microsoft PowerPoint and compared them to the lines of code to do Microsoft Word, I think we would discover many similarities. Blogs.msds or MSDN said, there were about 30 million lines of code in the Mac version of Microsoft Office back in 06. Students at code.org said there are 21 billion lines of code. Is this a lot? Well, by comparison, Microsoft Windows operating system has 50 million lines of code. If we compared the lines of code in the Mac version or the Microsoft version, even though they're vastly different in how they operate, there still may be some similar lines of code. This doesn't prove they're related. It doesn't prove either one's related to Morse code. It proves that's an efficient system of getting the point across, of getting the machine to do what you want it to do, to project a number or a shape on the screen. So they're doing good research on finding the similarities between these things, as Herman did earlier here. That's wonderful. That's good research, but coming to the wrong conclusion, especially dealing with something like a DNA code that is trillions of times more complex than a simple computer code, where really all you have is zeros and ones. Our primitive computer codes use zeros and ones, and the DNA uses four, C, A, T, and G. It is not, it's immensely more complex. One of the questions I was sent was, what specific predictions does special creationism make for comparative molecular genetic data? Creationists predict millions of similar genes, that would be the code, because many creatures need similar features, like they both need eyes, ears, lungs, etc. That just proves the same designer wrote the codes. And he might have given them the ability to react to the same environmental pressures in the same way. So we may see certain things happen, like he mentioned about the mutations or the changes between comparing, you know, how they react to different environmental pressures. Okay, well, it still could be the same designer. How are creationists going about testing these predictions? Well, first place, the creationists are not demanding that their religion be taught in tax-funded schools. The burden of proof is on the followers of the evolutionism religion. You guys are demanding that we all pay for your religion to be taught. You got the burden of proof, not me. If I was demanding creation to be taught, I would certainly, the burden of proof would be on me. I'm not. I just think kids ought to be taught science in science class, which says dogs produce dogs. Everything beyond that is a religion. If you want to believe dogs and bananas are related, that's okay, but it's not science. Is there any conceivable data that would be inconsistent with the idea of special creation? Well, yeah, there is. The Bible says the plants and animals will bring forth after their kind. If we could see any plant or animal violate that, that would prove it can be violated. Do you know of any examples? Either one of you or anybody you know, has anybody ever seen an example, not by drawing a line on a paper, but where you actually watched an animal or plant bring forth something other than its same kind? Now, we can see little variations, but that's and imagine that it, over longer periods of time, it might become a different kind. They've seen all kinds of variations in the horse kind, where we have race horses and quarter horses and, you know, Shetland ponies and miniature horses, and but always a horse. American Kennel Association now recognizes 339 breeds of dogs, from Chihuahuas to Great Danes or whatever's the biggest one. But they're always still a dog, and they always bring forth a dog, and they have the same dog characteristics: four legs, a tail, two eyes. They never bring forth a bird or a feather or anything outside what anybody, even a five-year-old, would consider the dog kind. So, yes, the Bible clearly says they will bring forth after their kind. I am unaware of anybody anywhere who has seen an exception to that. Now, they draw pictures about it, and they draw these artist conceptions of a missing link, but an artist conception is not observable science. What we see, and every farmer on planet Earth, every farmer in recorded history has counted on evolution not happening. When he crossbreeds his cows, he expects to get a cow. If you know of any examples, I think that would violate the Bible. Yes, sir, that would prove the Bible wrong. Please show me where this has happened. I would like to see that. Okay? So, eighth question I was given. Why would scientists across different faiths, or none at all, come to an overwhelming consensus on the idea of common ancestry if there were no compelling evidence? Well, maybe they've never seen my seminar, seen my DVDs. That would solve it. So appreciate you guys advertising for me. Tell them to watch drdino.com. Once they watch my videos, we can get them straightened out. Okay. Should scientists measure their findings against the Bible before accepting those results? It couldn't hurt, and it might help, but it should not be required. Nothing in the Bible's ever been proven wrong, and scores of Bible passages involving history or biology have been proven right. For instance, they'll bring forth after their kind. God said that in the first chapter of first chapter of Genesis, 10 times, the first chapter of the book. He said the plants and animals will always bring forth after their kind. I think that's a scientific prediction made by God himself. And I don't know of anybody, and if you have one, I want to see it. Not a drawing, I want to see it. The Bible is not a biology book, but when it makes a statement touching any topic, it's always been proven right. It's not a math book. It's not a history book. When it covers history, it's right. Nobody's ever proven anything wrong historically or biologically from the Bible. If you know of something, please tell me. So is the Bible the final authority in science? No. It is always right on science, but there's many things. Science is a broad field of study involving many, many disciplines, and the Bible doesn't address many of them. It's not on that topic. Just like my owner's manual for my Chevy doesn't deal with, you know, how to build a computer. So how do you explain Christians, if Pope is a Christian, such as Pope Francis, who see no impediment to being a Christian imposed by accepting evolution, whatever that word means, as an explanation for our biology? Catholics in general, and popes especially, have a long history of being wrong on topics relating to the Bible and to science. For instance, the selling of indulgences to forgive sins, that is not in the Bible, they are wrong. The idea of a purgatory, that is nowhere found in the Bible, that is wrong. The idea that the Pope or the priests are above everybody else, that is wrong. We're all children of God if you're saved. About wine actually becoming the blood and bread actually becoming the flesh of Christ. No, that's wrong. It's not true. It's not scientifically true, and it's not biblically true. So I don't know that I would put Catholics are not in the Christian category just by virtue of being a Catholic. A Christian is one who has Christ inside, born again, and most of them are trusting their church and not the Lord as their Savior. And as far as the word evolution, I think we probably should have early in this discussion defined exactly what you mean by that. I'd like to see Herman's definition of evolution. I could very clearly break it up into six parts: cosmic, chemical, stellar, organic. Somewhere in your theory, life has to get started from non-living material. That has to be part of your theory. If it's not, and lately they're saying, well, that's not part of evolution. Okay, well, then help me get that other part out of the books, because the books are still teaching it. I've got hundreds of high school biology books from 1880 on, and trust me, in the last 50 years especially, they do teach life came from non-living material. So it's an essential part of the evolution theory. Then you have what I call macroevolution, changes to a different kind. Nobody's ever seen that. They imagine it, and they draw pictures of it, and they draw lines on paper, but we've never seen a dog produce a non-dog, period. Now, microevolution, which is variations within the same kind, well, that happens all the time, but they're always limited. People sometimes get taller or shorter depending upon diet or depending on genetic code. There's all kinds of things to influence whether a person is going to be, you know, 6 foot tall or 5 foot eight. But there's nothing in the gene code going to make a person 400 feet tall or 2 inches tall. There are limits, small and large. So I'm not aware of any evidence for evolution. And if the Pope has accepted it, shame on him. He's wrong. Tell him to give me a call, 855-BIG-DINO, extension 3, and I'll straighten him out. Okay? I don't know how long that was, but that's long enough.
That's about equal, actually. So thanks, Kent.
Okay.
So Dr. Mays, do you want to pick a particular question out of these? I have the questions here, so I am familiar with them. Do you want to take one and kind of run with it and do kind of a rebuttal and a redirect?
Sure. So the beginning thing is Kent seems to be continuing on this notion that mere similarity alone is how evolutionary biologists build phylogenetic trees, despite the fact that I explained that that's not how we build phylogenetic trees. If you go back to the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there were what we call phonetic approaches to building phylogenies that were based on just similarity. Nobody uses those methods for decades, hasn't used those methods for decades, and we certainly don't use phonetic methods based on simple similarity in molecular phylogenetics. Molecular phylogenetics poses hypotheses that make predictions of the data, and we measure those hypotheses against the data, just like I said. We either do it in a likelihood framework, getting the probability of the data given a particular hypothesis or tree, or the probability of the hypothesis or the tree given the data.
Well, let's ask that to Kent. Kent, what is the data that you have that's comparable to what Dr. Mays had as far as the young Earth creationist hypothesis and the experimental and observational data that shows what your hypothesis would be correct or not?
Well, yeah, I think I saw everything he presented. I think I heard it and understood it, but I don't think he caught what I said. What he said is we're drawing the inference of these trees. First, he's assuming that a tree exists at all. All we've ever observed is dogs produce dogs. Nobody's ever seen anything other than that. Never.
Well, yeah,
so that is science. Drawing a line on a piece of paper saying dogs are related to anything else is simply imagination. This isn't science.
Dr. Mays, would we expect a population of dogs to have anything else other than dogs?
Well, there's a couple points on that. One, of course, organisms within a generation give birth. Dogs in one generation will give birth to dogs the next generation. That's obvious. And in fact, if that didn't happen, if dogs didn't give birth to dogs, or what we call like doesn't beget like, that's a fundamental principle of genetics that is essential for evolution to work. Because if offspring did not resemble their parents, we couldn't have evolution by natural selection take place in the first place. But I'm not really here to talk about natural selection per se. I'm here to talk about common ancestry. Now, the other thing he said was that if we can show him any evidence of that actually happening, because that's the norm, where within a generation, one species gives birth to offspring of the same species. There are exceptions to that, that he seems unaware of. So plants, for example, are well known to have hybridization events that produce offspring that are reproductively incompatible with either parent species that produced them. and they can only reproduce with other hybrids. So within a single generation, they become reproductively isolated from their parents, and it is speciation in a single generation.
And that would Mac revolution? Would that be a Mac revolution due to polyploidy and whole genome
generation? Well, that's the other thing. That's a speciation event. So that's speciation by hybridization. Macroevolution also doesn't seem to understand what it is. He says it's change to a different kind. Now, I have a question for Kent about macroevolution. So, Kent, would you think it's fair to conclude that, I don't know if you're a bird watcher, but if you've seen any sort of wood warblers, you know, around your home, or, you know, sometimes if you're down south, maybe in the wintertime you see wood warblers, different kinds of wood warblers that are around in North America, would you say that it's reasonable to conclude that they came from a wood warbler common ancestor, a single wood warbler common ancestor?
Good. That's better. All right. We got four or five topics started here in that last interchange there. You said, of course, dogs produce dogs. In one generation, that would be the norm. Well, what about in five generations or 500 generations? Or how many generations of bacteria have they raised in the laboratory, or fruit flies? They did that one for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of generations, which is, you know, compressing tens of thousands of years of human reproduction down into one observable lifespan of flies, okay? So, you said there are exceptions to the idea of something producing, and you use plants as an example, where they're reproductively incompatible with their parents. It is still a plant. I would bet a five-year-old would call it the same kind of plant. Now, you may decide it's a new species, and somebody may decide that this is a new species of plant, like, I don't know which one you're referring to, broccoli, cauliflower, et cetera, probably all related, but it's still the same kind. It's a plant.
Okay. So if then it's still a plant, and I'll change my wood warbler question to a plant question. Okay. Because there's just still plants, would it seem reasonable to you that all plants share a single plant common ancestor?
No, I'm not sure how many kinds of original plants there were, but...
Let's say all orchids. Would all orchids be reasonable to you to share a single orchid common ancestor?
Well, orchids are a very interesting plant, as able to survive on top of other plants with no roots.
Well, I'm not asking how interesting they are. I'm asking you, do you find it reasonable to conclude, based on your view of this, that all orchids could stem from a single orchid common ancestor?
I don't know that I could answer that question quickly.
Well, how about all grasses? Could all grasses share a single grass common ancestor?
Let's assume, just to pick a number, that God made 100 different kinds of grasses, from bamboo down to the itty-bitty microscopic grass. I don't know how many kinds he made. But if you made 100 kinds of grass, and they have now diversified into 5,000 species, like there's over 1,000 species. There are 1,000 species of bamboo, recognized species of bamboo. I don't know how many varieties or kinds of bamboo God made, which would be in the grass family, as you mentioned about the grasses. So I think that would be a valuable field of research that probably biologists should do. How many original created kinds were there?
Do you know any created kind that you could define besides a human being?
Why besides a human being? I think the human being is a classic
example. Obvious that you're going to,
Okay, can you give me any examples where a human has produced something other than a human?
I can't give you any examples of organisms. I mean, that's an essential part of evolution, that organisms have offspring that are like themselves. If they didn't do that, then evolution wouldn't work, because that means that any mutation that occurs in one individual wouldn't be passed on to the next generation and wouldn't have the opportunity to spread. So the fact that individuals produce offspring that look like them is absolutely essential to evolutionary theory that work. And that goes back to Darwin. He recognized that. My question is about macroevolution and whether or not you understand what it is. So would there be any group of organisms that you would say it's reasonable to conclude that they share a single, even created kind?
Well, let's take the most obvious, humans. Do you know of any humans that have ever produced a non-human or have ever come from a non-human?
I don't expect them to.
Well, then they should, if evolution is true. This falsifies your theory.
No, not in a single generation. You never qualified this idea that like begets like. It is some... There's some generational limit on it, that you just said dogs give birth to dogs and dogs, you know, that's it. So that leads everyone to believe that you're talking about a single generation. No, humans, you have like individuals from one generation to the next.
But do you believe humans came from something that was non-human? You can have as many generations in the past as you want to imagine. Let's go back 400 trillion generations.
But I'm asking, I'm trying to get you to answer a question about macroevolution and what it is, because
I'm trying to get you to answer a question.
Yeah, I think humans evolved from a non-human ancestor, and each generation during that process, that branching tree, phylogenetic bifurcating process of populations, each generation, individuals were giving birth to individuals that are like them. So throughout the process of change, within each generation, individuals were giving birth to individuals that are like them.
So if
I have a mutation in my germline, I'm going to pass that on to my offspring. That mutation is new to me, and I'm going to pass it on to my offspring because of this rule that offspring resemble parents. Now, over time, mutations start accumulating in different lineages, and if two lineages become independent and they don't have gene flow anymore, they're going to diverge and become more different from one another. But within that process, each generation, individuals are giving birth to offspring that resemble themselves. Now, again, I'm trying to ask you about macroevolution. Is there any group, grasses, wood warblers, orchids, that you would think it's at least reasonable to conclude? Like, would it be, for instance, would you think that if there was some creationist research on grasses, and they concluded that all grasses share a single grass common ancestor, would that go against any of your beliefs in the Bible or anything?
Well, the Bible uses the Hebrew word was baraminology, which is translated kind. They bring forth after their kind. Okay. As I mentioned, there are 1,000 varieties or species of bamboo. There might have only been one variety in the original creation. I don't know. Maybe there were 50.
Okay.
You talked a long time. You give me equal time here now. Okay. You mentioned wood warblers. Let's take the wood warbler. Do you believe, and you can have all the trillions of years you want, go back and imagine anything you want. Do you believe wood warblers are related to grass?
Yes, but they don't have trillions of years because that's absurd. There's no evidence of trillions of years. I'm asking you a question.
How long ago were they related, and what did this common ancestor between a bird and grass look like?
The common ancestor between plants and animals goes back to the origins of the eukaryotes. And that's not really a subject that we're here to discuss, but that's a eukaryotic ancestor. It was neither a plant and neither an animal. It was a eukaryotic organism.
Now, is this something you have scientific observation for or something you believe? Yes,
like
observation of it.
We have clear evidence for common ancestry because there's two models at play here that are competing with one another against the data. One, individuals or populations or species, kinds, whatever you want to call it, appear independent of one another at the same time and develop independently. They have an independent genetic trajectories. That's a creationist model. The other model is common ancestry, that species have common ancestors in the past. Those two models make entirely different predictions of the data. Now, I'm trying to get you to answer this question that at least admit that you don't have anything against the idea that there was one created kind of grass that evolved into all the grasses we see today.
Okay, I answered the question three times. I'll answer it once more. I don't know how many original created kinds there were. And I'm not going to tell you all the grasses came from a kind of grass. There might have been 50 original kinds of grass.
In that case, if you're willing to accept that all grasses came from a single created
I'm not willing to accept that. Don't put words in my mouth. I said there might have been 50 original created kinds of grasses.
Okay, let's say it's
500.
Let's say it's 50.
Okay.
Let's say it's 50. And there's thousands of species today. So those thousands of species evolved from those 50 original species.
I said I don't know how many there were, but...
Well, I'm just saying, I'm asking you if creationist researchers decide they want to do research in this field, and they discover that there was one created kind of grass or 50, would you have anything against, like philosophical or theological, against that conclusion?
No, I would say grass is still grass, and grass always produces grass.
You can say grass is still grass, but the point I'm trying to make is that is macroevolution.
No, it is not.
Is not what you characterize it as. Macroevolution is diversity that we see above the level of species. So any evolutionary process that produces diversity above the level of species is, a, by definition, a macroevolutionary thing. So given that grasses have lots of different families even, and different genera and different species, their diversity is way above the level of species. So they're, if they diversified from a single grass ancestor, that by definition is macroevolution. And macroevolution involves three things.
Hold it. You're taking more time. Give me a chance to respond one at a time. First of all, you are making this. This is SpongeBob imagination stuff that grasses
I know
came
from. Catchphrase, but
okay. Well, it's so this true. I don't have a better way to say it.
The definition. Okay. This is SpongeBob imagination. This is the definitions from actual evolutionary biology textbooks.
Okay.
Macroevolution is change that results in diversity above the level of species.
Well, I didn't use the word species. You did. I said kinds. Is it still grass?
You said changes to a different kind.
Okay, is it still?
And that's not what.
That's, is it still grass?
If you define it as a species, then you're defining macroevolution as speciation, which is part of the process of macroevolution.
Macroevolution would be where animals produce something other than their kind, K-I-N-D, not species.
Kent, that's not what it is.
A dog and a wolf are different species. Are they interfertile?
Yes. Well, sometimes, yeah.
What exactly is a species?
A species is a metapopulation lineage that is we define by having an independent genetic trajectory. So what that means is that if we look at the population genetics of a potential species, if it behaves in a way that consistent with a population genetic model is independent, meaning it doesn't show any evidence that there's gene flow between it and another population, that's a species. Being a species doesn't necessarily mean reproductive incompatibility. It just means a population lineage that goes on independent of other lineages with either not even no gene flow, but just reduced or, you know, very little gene flow.
Okay.
But well, that's not your definition of a species is not the definition of species. That's the what we call a unified definition of a species that incorporates many different other species concepts, phylogenetic species concept, biological
species. Okay. Well, let's take the one that's easiest to understand. Are all humans the same species?
All modern humans are the
all
same.
Modern humans all are humans, the same species.
All humans are not all humans that have ever existed are not the same species. If you define human as a member of the genus Homo, because there have been different species of in that genus in the past.
Well, you're imagining that in the past. This is not science. It's observational science.
No,
tell us.
We find fossils are real things that we observe that are data about the world around us. And there were different species of human beings in the past. We not only have their fossils, we have their DNA as well. But again, this is getting beside the point.
Don't slap and run now. Let me answer each topic or somebody's going to think you're right on that one. Fossils are dead. They don't talk. They don't have a date on them. We put our interpretation on them. Just like drawing your lines on a piece of paper, you're drawing conclusions about a fossil that it was capable of doing something that no human today can do. No human today can produce a non-human. But yet you think something that was non-human produced a human. This is imagination.
I said that.
You just did. You said the fossils could do it.
I said generation, individuals are giving birth to offspring that resemble them. Mutations occur. And if a mutation occurs in an individual in its germline, it could be passed on to that offspring. So that offspring will resemble it in terms of that mutation as well, in terms of that change.
Okay, how many changes?
Resembling parents is also the way in which mutations get spread. So,
I understand real well. Okay, can you cite for the audience here any it would take trillions of mutations to turn a grass into a human. Can you tell me any mutations?
Trillions of mutations to turn. I mean, they don't have even that much. I mean, some have a lot of DNA, but grasses don't turn into humans.
Grasses and humans have a common ancestor.
There's no evolutionary model that says grasses turn into humans. None.
There is. I have evolutionary pictures from my textbook showing grasses and humans related by drawing a line on a paper.
They're related, but that doesn't mean one turns into the other.
You are completely missing the point. Now, I would like you to answer my simple question here. You're claiming all this happens because of mutations. Would you please cite for the audience and God who is listening here, what mutations are you aware of that have added new information and been beneficial and have been passed on to the next generation? Is this something you imagine like SpongeBob, or can you actually cite a beneficial mutation that has caught on and changed the population and has added new information?
There are enormous numbers of beneficial mutations, from metabolic enzymes in bacteria to lactose tolerance in people. There are mutations that explain the difference between chlorophylls and what substrates the chlorophylls will strip electrons from. There's tons of different beneficial mutations in everything from bacteria to humans to fruit flies to birds to plants and everything. If beneficial doesn't mean really what you think it means. When we talk about beneficial mutations in evolutionary biology, we just means that those mutations in that particular environment, in that particular population, have a relative fitness advantage. That's all that means.
So my question was a little different, though. I said, are you aware of any mutations that added new genetic information?
All mutations add information. All of them do.
Beneficial or negative? Are most mutations?
I just gave you examples of beneficial mutations as well.
Well, lactose tolerance, I don't know that that's still going to be a human, isn't it?
You just ask if mutations give beneficial information, are beneficial or not. I explained to you what beneficial means.
Okay, so how is that going to change? How is that ever going to change grass into a human or a common ancestor of grass and humans? How is lactose tolerance going to change whatever the ancestor was between grass and humans?
It might not, but that's not what you asked.
Can't go ahead and...
Yeah, we need to... Well, let's let it evolve here. It should get better by itself.
It might not lead to a new species, but natural selection is a change occurring within a population is different than the speciation process. You just asked for if there are beneficial mutations. That's a totally different question than whether or not those mutations will lead to speciation. They may or may not. They're beneficial, and they are.
Okay, let's keep this in the line where the average person can understand it. With humans, again, are you aware of any, and I would point out in a court of law, no fossil would count as evidence for anything, because all you know is it died. You couldn't prove that fossil had any children. And you certainly couldn't prove it had children that were different, since all animals today produce the same kind. Humans produce humans. Monkeys produce monkeys. So why would you think a fossil could do something other than that? So I would discount all fossils as non-evidence for evolution. We observe 7.4 billion people on the planet today, many of them having children, and they always produce humans.
And That's all that's ever happened. Exactly what evolution would expect.
That's exactly what creation would expect, too. They bring forth after their kind.
Sure. But let's talk about the other things and the topic of the actual discussion that we had agreed to have, and that's the evidence for the comparative merits of the two models, a single ancestry creation model versus a common ancestry one. Now, you keep making claims that of these changes somehow are there for a reason, but I'm not sure what that reason is. If we're talking about synonymous neutral variation, how would you expect that variation to vary among different created kind lineages?
Very good question.
I have a satisfactory answer to that.
Okay, I'll give you one. I would expect the creator to design the original created kinds with the ability to adapt to a variety of environments. Some of the humans that came out of Adam's loins.
I have to stop you right here, because I'm not talking about adaptation at all. I'm talking about whether or not neutral variation that has no effect on natural selection at all, what that tells us about ancestry. It has nothing to do with natural selection. I'm only talking about those genetic markers that are neutral.
Sure. Okay, I don't know that would necessarily tell us anything about history. You can put your interpretation on it. What we see are dogs produce dogs. Some live in cold climate, some live in warm climate. Some have thin fur, some have thick fur, some have long legs, some have short legs.
That's not.
I agree. Natural selection can only.
Hang on, if I may, let me see if I can clarify this, because I think you guys are talking past each other. If I may, if that's okay, Kent, what he's asking you, if I'm not mistaken, natural selection doesn't act on neutral mutations. It only acts on beneficial or detrimental mutations. So he's asking you, if you have neutral variation, then how do you have these nested hierarchical patterns? Because natural selection is not going to act upon them. Is that what you're asking, Dr. Mace?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And And I asked, what exactly beneficial mutations is this natural selection working on that's going to change?
I'm not talking about beneficial mutations at all.
He's talking about neutral mutations.
Neutral mutations.
With respect to the environment. Okay.
Well, if neutral mutations do nothing, why are we talking about it at all? Is that going to add up to something? A bunch of neutral are you now counting on neutral mutations to add up to changing it to a new kind? What kind of neutral mutations would change a grass, the ancestor of grass and humans? Into
They wouldn't. That's not the point.
That is the point.
The point is that that's data, and you have two competing models, common ancestry and independent origins, which is the creation model in this case. We have genetic variation. We have genetic variation that doesn't have any, doesn't vary with function. So you can't just easily dismiss it by talking about natural selection or function or design, because it doesn't have any influence on design. It's the same product in every gene, but the genes vary still. Now the question is, what does that variation tell us about those species' history? Is it more consistent with a common ancestry model or more consistent with a special creation model?
Okay.
And all you can do is talk about natural selection, which is not the point.
Okay, all of the variations ever observed in human history leave the creature, whether it be plant or animal, in the same kind. Horses, zebras, quaggas, I don't know what all kinds of horses there are, and they're still interfertile in some cases. They get zorses and zonkies and zedonks. They don't normally crossbreed, but they can. And I think a five-year-old kid could show you that a horse and a zebra are the same kind of animal, and they're a different kind than frogs and grass. I think a five-year-old could show you that.
I'm sure so they could, but I'm not here to talk about a five-year-old's understanding of biology. I'm here to talk about an adult person's educated version of biology. I get five-year-olds understand things like a five-year-old will understand them. I'm here to talk to you about the science. And the science says that you have two models. They make different predictions of the data. And when you look at neutral variation, so the reason we're looking at neutral variation is to eliminate this possibility of selection explaining the pattern or even design explaining the pattern and things like that. That's the whole reason we look at that. So let me give you an example. Do you think that if you submit your DNA to Ancestry.com or one of these services, that they could take that DNA and place your genome in the context of some population history, human population history? And how do you think they do that?
Well, I think they would very quickly trace mine back to Norway. I think because all four of my grandparents came over from Norway.
I get it, but how is that done? What sorts of genetic markers do they use to trace your ancestry to certain populations?
Well, I don't know the details on how they exactly do that, but I know we have DNA similarities between all the Norwegians. Well, the DNA is incredibly complicated.
I can tell you how they do it.
Well, I'm not interested right now. I think if you look at the lines of code for my...
I asked you a question and you said you don't know. So
let me give you the answer that I have.
You just said you don't know how they do it. That was the question.
The DNA is incredibly complex, but I'm trying to get you to see a bigger picture. Comparing similar DNA between me and all other Norwegians might prove there are genetic markers that all Norwegians have and all Namibians do not have. Okay, that's probably true, but we're still human and we're still interfertile. You do not get it. Humans produce humans.
The point
you don't
is,
get it.
DNA is complicated and there's a lot we don't know, but this we do know.
Okay.
We can use neutral genetic variation to place your genome in the context of a particular population history. And the exact same methodology, using that same neutral variation, is the type of variation that I'm talking about when we look deeper into evolutionary history, differences between species and or common ancestry between species and families, et cetera. It's the same technique.
I understand. Heard every word and understand. Now, so the similarities that I have with other Norwegians, even though I've never been to Norway, that same type of data you're going to use to prove that humans and grass are related if you go back far enough. Is that your
variation? Yes. And there's a reason for that, because it's the same process. It's the same process. We can look for patterns of common ancestry when we look at neutral genetic variation. Again, it's two models, and the data are only going to support, they're going to support the predictions of one model or the other. Now, I haven't heard your model necessarily make any clear predictions.
Okay, I'll make one right now. I predict humans will always produce humans. every, no matter what climate you go to, no matter what country you go to, no matter how far back in history you go, you will never see an example, never, in that where a human has produced a non-human or come from a non-human.
Well, Ken, I need
that's my prediction.
I need predictions that we can test without the benefit of a time machine.
Go to the hospital. Go to the maternity ward.
Based on the data we have right now, okay. What predictions does your model make of the data when it comes to neutral genetic variation?
My model predicts humans will produce humans, and the mutations.
That's not what I'm asking.
No, you mean that's not what you want to hear?
No, that's not the question I'm asking.
Kent, it's not the question he's asking, actually. He's asking you what you can do now to provide experimental data that supports your hypothesis of what you're trying to put forth for the young earth creationist position.
I go to any maternity ward and watch when the baby's born. It will be a human.
But that's consistent with the evolutionary prediction as well.
That is consistent with the idea that humans and grass have a common ancestor? Come on. You've got to be kidding.
What?
You can believe humans and grass are related if you want, and you can draw lines on your paper, and they do, showing plants and humans are related. That's not science.
The SpongeBob stuff is just—it's not cutting it. These are slogans that you use. It's meaningless. I've told you, phylogenetic biologists don't merely just draw lines on paper.
Yes, they do.
Dr. Mace,
I explained to you how it works.
Dr. Mace, let me ask this question to both of you then. I think both of you would agree that humans produce humans and monophyletically will continue to produce humans. So the question would be, if the young earth creationist position is correct, if the hypothesis that they're putting forth is correct, there has to be something distinguishing it from the evolutionary model. The evolutionary model says that humans produce humans and will continue to do so because it's a nested hierarchy. So what would be something that you would suggest, Kent, that an experiment can be done, an observation can be done, that separates it from the evolutionary theory to make it distinguishable. So you can say, evolutionary theory does not predict this. My model does. Therefore, my model is better or more parsimonious.
Right. And I might add, it needs to be predictions that we can measure against the data we can have right now. We can't use some time machine to go into the future and look at what humans may or may not look like. With the data we have right now, that we can access right now, how would we test your hypothesis?
Okay, the data we have right now is 7.4 billion humans on the planet, many producing babies, which are humans. We have about 5,000 or 6,000 years of recorded human history where people have kept records of humans producing humans. Anything other than that is outside of observable science. You can imagine that these mutations, positive, negative, or neutral, can change it from grass to a human or from a grass-like ancestor to human, but this is not science.
What you don't understand is that it's not the mutations that are changing anything. The mutations in this sense that we use to test models of common ancestry are merely markers of history. They have no role in changing. They're just sort of a byproduct of speciation. They're not the cause of speciation. And so it's the same principle allows us to test your Norwegian ancestry or put part of your genes in Africa or part of your genes in Asia or wherever. And it's the same process. These are merely markers of history. And what we know about genetics tells us that lineages accumulate mutations over time. So these mutations, and if those two lineages never shared the same gene pool, meaning they never shared a common ancestry, they will be accumulating changes that are independent of other ones. That looks very different. That we have very different expectations for what the data looks like in that case compared to they inherited a certain change from a common ancestor. That's an entirely different prediction for the data. Again, these aren't causing things to turn into other things. They're merely markers of history in this case. And so the question is, are those markers consistent with your model or a common ancestry model? And I haven't really gotten a clear answer on that other than you just believe that your model is right. I haven't heard a clear path or research program that you could implement to where what data you could collect to, you know, test this idea.
Well, my model is that every animal or plant will always produce after its kind. And there'll be variations within that kind.
Yeah, You keep saying that over and over again, and I
because it's true, and you're not getting it.
No, I do.
Humans, you do not get it. Dogs produce dogs, and you believe dogs and grass are related, and you teach students that, and you use tax dollars to do it. Man, go start a private school and teach that stupidity to kids who want to learn it. That's not science. Science is what we observe, study, and test and demonstrate. That's not science. It's a religion. You have a religion, Herman. Admit it. I was just pointing out that this is his religion. This isn't science. Humans produce humans and dogs produce dogs. And if he wants to think humans and dogs are related, that's fine. But he shouldn't be teaching this as science, and he shouldn't be using tax dollars to do it. It's not part of science. Science is what we observe. You can believe that, and you do. You believe humans and grass are related. That's fine.
I can show you all the observations you want. I've been showing you observations. The data that I just show you are observations. Those are sequences that we get from living things, and we compare them in a way that's either consistent with one model or consistent with another model.
I understand.
And it's an overwhelming case. Some of these tests have p-values to where you'd get a worse fit with a creation model, about one in every 40 billion chance of getting a worse fit between the data and that model.
Sure, so, and you're welcome to believe whatever you want to believe. You can use any models you want to believe, but observable science tells us dogs produce dogs.
I observe the data. That's enough observation. DNA sequences are observations in science. Those DNA's, are observations. We models. We build models to explain diversity.
Okay,
and those models are predictions. And the observations we get are the data we collect. So this is entirely observable.
What if I went through Louis L'Amour's book and found out how many times he used the letter O per thousand letters?
Books have nothing to do with it.
It does indeed.
Similarities between sentences and books and Louis L'Amour and movies and whatever else you want to bring up is completely irrelevant.
This is what you're doing with DNA. It's a code. DNA is a code. It's the same thing.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. Come on. We've got an hour and a half, guys.
Do books have sex and reproduce?
Okay, one sec. I think we're hitting kind of a brick wall here.
All right.
There were some people who have submitted some questions that we've kind of gone through. Would you guys be okay with answering a couple of those?
Yeah, sure.
Real quick. Okay. This question is going to go to Kent.
Okay.
And it says, we see a layer of iridium found everywhere, all over the world. If you're following the version of the Bible, where is this global layer supporting a flood?
Well, iridium is very interesting. It's a rare element. There's a long article about this on ICR, which is Institute for Creation Research, icr.org. I think if you had a global flood, accompanied catastrophic events, especially launching stuff out into space, probably from the hydroplate theory, which I cover in my seminar. You can go to Walt Brown's website, creationscience.com. He's also got a long article about the iridium. If you want to study specifically, creationscience.com. Walt Brown, PhD in physics, taught at the Air Force Academy for years, and is a creationist. So I don't know that I could tell you. I do know that all over the world there are layers of rock, and that indicates rapid deposition, oftentimes containing fossils, which indicate rapid burial before they had time to decay. So I think it's very clear evidence of a flood with rapid deposition of layers, including polystrata fossils, trees standing up, petrified, running between these layers. You'd watch my seminar. That's why the Pope believes in evolution. He's never seen my seminar. If he watched that, it would save the planet.
Okay. And Dr. Mays, what is your opinion on a missing link? Do you think there is sufficient evidence showing that there is no missing link anymore, or do you think there is still a missing link?
Missing link for what? Did they specify?
They didn't specify, but I'm assuming they're talking about the
humans?
Yes, that's what I'm assuming that they're talking about.
Missing link is sort of a terrible term. It's one of these buzzword terms from and sometimes even among evolutionary biologists they use it pretty carefree. Evolutionary biologists use a lot of terminology sometimes very loose because they understand what they mean. But sometimes when they use it, they don't realize that the people listening to the term don't necessarily understand. Missing links imply a very directional, goal-orientated, progressive sort of idea of evolution that isn't really how evolution works. What we look at in the fossil record is we find evidence of traits that are transitional, not species that are transitional, but character states that are transitional. And what we find in the fossil record are species that have a mosaic of characteristics between two groups that we thought might be pretty different. Those are the sorts of, that's the sort of evidence that we have in the fossil record that supports common ancestry and supports change over time. But missing links are not necessarily our direct ancestors. They're just evidence of character evolution, basically. That said, we have enormous amounts of evidence in the fossil record for common ancestry and transitional states in various, all kinds of characters and characteristics in all kinds of different organisms. So there's, and in humans, the fossil record, because of where humans in the past lived, was amenable to fossilization. And also because there's just so many people interested in humans, there's more people looking for those fossils. So we have an enormously rich and record of human evolution.
And Kent, did you want to follow up?
First place, there is no such thing as a fossil record. There are a lot of fossils, but it's us putting an interpretation on them just as easily explained with a global flood, which would, of course, automatically sort creatures by similar body density or similar habitat. You would expect to find birds in one layer, generally the top layers, because they fly. That's how they run out of gas. Of course, they don't drown first. They drown last. And you'd expect to find fish lower than birds, which would not necessarily mean one evolved to the other. It's just hydrologic sorting, or just by habitat, or by body density, or by intelligence. There's no evidence of any change over time. And even if there were, using a fossil to claim it's some kind of a transition, this is ludicrous. Wouldn't hold up 2 seconds in an honest court of law. All you know is the creature died. You don't know it was the ancestor of anybody. And all we observe is dogs produce dogs and cows produce cows. You can believe they're related if you want and draw a line on paper if you want. But that's not science. Science is things we observe, study, test, and demonstrate. Go breed your dogs and breed your cows and come up with something other than a cow or a dog. It's never been, and they've tried. They've tried and tried to get faster horses for racing. So far, all they've ever been able to get is a horse. Why don't you breed wings on it and fly around the track?
If I can ask, Ken, because you have mentioned this before. Sure. If we do find a fossil, why does it matter if that particular fossil has had offspring or not?
My point would be, in a court of law, you could not prove that it is the ancestor of anybody.
My question is, why would it matter, though?
Well, because this is what they're claiming is their evidence for their theory. And it's not evidence for anything. It's evidence something died.
Let me go back to the Ancestry.com example. If you submit your DNA to Ancestry.com, and then you get the results back in the mail, and you get something that says a certain percentage of your DNA comes from this population, another percentage comes from that, and you find those results generally believable, right? Do they send you the names of addresses of each and every one of your ancestors when you submit your DNA to Ancestry.com?
I doubt that, but they're all human. I guarantee they don't.
What we do is we get DNA and we can test hypotheses about relatedness that are built on common ancestry without actually showing common ancestors. So, for instance, I know that you're more related to your siblings, if you have siblings, than you are to your cousins. And I know that without ever knowing who your parents or your grandparents are.
Uh-huh.
So if you were adopted and we could test some people who are putatively perhaps your siblings or your cousins, we could tell them apart without ever knowing your direct ancestors. So knowing direct ancestry is not something that is required for evolution in the first place. You keep saying, well, the fossils, we don't know that they're our ancestors. We don't know if they have kids. Sure, who cares? That's not part of how we test ideas in evolution to begin with. So it doesn't matter. The fossil record doesn't preserve genealogies. It preserves evidence of common ancestry.
So it doesn't preserve evidence of common ancestry either. It preserves evidence that something died. End of story. It doesn't preserve evidence of common ancestry.
And fossils and their comparative analysis is what I'm talking about.
Ken, let me ask you this. If you had in future generations, let's say we go 5 or 6 future generations down the line to your great-grandchildren, and we looked at their DNA, we compared it to a fossil of one of your cousins now, that's extant now, your cousin may have not had any offspring, but could they not tell that your great-great-great-great-grandchildren have a common relationship to your cousin now?
Oh, I would predict I would bet any amount of money you want to bet that my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will be 100% human.
That wasn't my question. That's not my question, though. My question is, are your, if we took the DNA sample from your great-great-great-grandkids and we looked at your extant cousin today, could we not tell that they have a common relationship to your grandparents?
They would find out that it's human DNA in every single case. Okay. There may be variations.
They find out that it's human. They know it's human. They know your great-great-great-great-grandkids are human. They know all that. Now, what can they tell about the relatedness between a cousin that you had now? That's what we want to know. Not whether or not they're human, it's but what can we know about their relatedness?
Sure. They could tell probably how diverse they are and how far.
About their relatedness.
They could probably tell how closely related, but they're all within the gene code of humans.
That's not it.
Herman, you're claiming an
ancestral sample. Direct.
You are imagining that we are related to grass.
Well, hang on. You guys are talking over each other, so let's.
Sorry.
So it's okay. We're not related to grass.
So we're not talking about grass right now. We're just talking about humans.
He believes grass and humans are related, and he wants me to pay to have him teach that to kids.
Okay, but Kent,
I resent that.
Kent, hang on. The fact is, though, you've said that the great grandchildren we can tell are related to your extant cousin today. If your cousin did not have any offspring, he still is a common ancestor. He still is related to your great-great-great-great-grandchildren. That fossil we found from your cousin, if he did get fossilized, it didn't matter whether that cousin had offspring or not. It's still a fossil that we found that we know is related to your great-great-great-great-grandchildren. Would it not be that case?
That is still within the kind of human.
That's fine. That's not what we're asking.
Totally agree with that.
Well, no, but you're the one that is trying to take these little, really minor variations with hair color and skin color and try to make humans related to grass. This is stupid. This is not evidence we're related to a whale or grass. You can believe that all you want, but you should go teach that in a religious school, not a science class.
I think for clarification, real quick, Dr. Mays, if you would, in kind of a summary terms, could you explain, because he keeps mentioning, you know, the fact that you think that grass becomes a human. Can you kind of tell the audience position behind that, why that is the case?
Yeah, it goes back to the whole thing I opened up with, talking about the evidence for common ancestry and how we test common ancestry. So this idea that there's some relationship between humans and apes, whales and cattle, grass and mammals, anything, all those ideas are hypotheses that we can test and measure against the data. And those hypotheses make predictions of the data. So one thing that we can do is we can look at the data and see if it's consistent with this idea of it's not just grass is a very evolved species. In fact, grass is a very recent species of plant. They sort of evolved along with the mammals really at the end of the Cretaceous. They're not an old plant. So they were evolving after animals have been evolving for hundreds of millions of years. So it's silly to suggest that grasses are turning into people. Now, what we look at is whether or not just grasses, but all plants and all animals share a common ancestry. And that idea is an idea that makes predictions. If it were true, then the data that we observe would look a certain way. If it were not true, then the data we observe would look a different way. The data we happen to observe supports the conclusion that plants and animals share a common ancestry. And that common ancestry goes back to the appearance of the eukaryotes, which is what plants and animals and fungi and protists and other organisms are all eukaryotes.
And still today, humans and well as plants are still eukaryotic.
Yes.
For that very reason.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you could say, you know, when Kent keeps saying things like, well, there's still plants or there's still humans, I could say, well, grasses and humans share a common ancestry, evolve from a common ancestor, but they're still just eukaryotes. Plants and humans are still eukaryotes. So where does this is the silly thing about they're still dogs, they're still humans, they're still grasses, they're still orchids, they're still birds. That's an arbitrary thing. I can just as easily say that in terms of grasses and humans and just say, well, yeah, they evolved from a common ancestor, but they're both still eukaryotes.
So. Right, Kent, you want to respond?
You misquoted me to start. I did not say grass becomes a human. I said what he just said. He believes, and he admitted it, grass and humans share a common ancestor.
Sure, but they're still just eukaryotes.
It's my turn to talk. You said, and you still believe, right this moment, you believe grass and humans have a common ancestor. I did not say grass becomes a human. I said exactly what he said. That's what he believes. Now, he said grass is a very evolved species. As far as anybody's ever observed, grass produces grass. Now, somebody might try to select certain characteristics, like faster growing if they're in the lawn business, or, you know, short grass for golf greens or something like that. They've probably helped it along by selecting certain traits that they like. People have taken dog species and have selected, you know, smallness to get a Chihuahua and bigness to get something else. But the more they select away from the normal average generic dog, the more problems they get. Most of these varieties of species of dogs, or varieties of dogs that have been selectively bred in the last few hundred years, wouldn't survive 2 days in the woods by themselves. They have to be babysat all the time. Chihuahuas wouldn't last 1 day in the woods. They'd be bear food or buzzard bait. So yes, there are variations within the kind, sometimes some pretty incredible variations. If you only found the bones, probably nobody would think the Chihuahua and the Doberman are related, but they are. They had a common ancestor, and it was a dog. Now, the Bible says clearly that all the animals and all the plants will bring forth after their kind. You haven't shown any evidence. You've shown a model that you have chosen to interpret as, oh, look at this similarity or the difference in the DNA, and you interpret it to mean they're related. But science deals with what we observe, and we observe grass produces grass, and dogs produce dogs, and humans produce humans. Anything other than that is your religion. Herman, I wish you'd just admit it. You believe it, and that's fine. This is America. You can have any religion you want, but you shouldn't have all of us pay to have that taught to all the kids. That's not fair.
Well, Ken, people can sit down and talk about exactly what I've been talking about, and we do. And I've been in science for 25 years, as a professional person for 25 years. And I've sat down with a lot of people. And among professional scientists, this is basic stuff. There is no disagreement in any of the people that I've sat and talked to for 25 years.
You're sitting with the wrong crowd.
I'm going to finish. And the people that I talk to come from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different religious backgrounds, a lot of different political backgrounds, a lot of different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. There's no one common denominator that makes people, ideological common denominator that makes people believe in evolution. There are Catholics who believe in evolution. There are Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christians who believe in evolution. There are atheists who believe in evolution, of course. There are evangelical Christians who believe in evolution. There are Jews who believe in evolution. There are Buddhists who believe in evolution. So it's not a religious view or a worldview. You know, the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky wrote a paper in the early 70s to the American Science Teachers, a journal for the American Science Teachers Association. And the title of the paper was "Nothing in Biology Makes Sense Outside of the Light of Evolution." Dobzhansky was an Eastern Orthodox Christian. And even today, that statement, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution," is on a plaque in the science building at the University of Notre Dame on the floor, on a big tile on the floor. So this has nothing to do with people's religion. Nothing. It makes no difference to me. You know, I could change my religious beliefs tomorrow, and it wouldn't have any effect at all on how I view the evidence for evolution. So this notion that it's a religion is nonsense. It's an argument that people, creationists, use so that they don't have to argue the science.
Well, that was very interesting. You said Jews believe in evolution. You listed a whole bunch of people. I didn't write them all down. But this is proves my point exactly. They believe in evolution. This is their religion.
You're right. In fact, that's the one thing in this discussion that I'll give you, that you have corrected me, and you're absolutely right. It's loose talk for me to say I believe in evolution. And scientists don't believe in evolution as an article of faith. I will correct myself based on that, and I thank you for bringing that up. I'm convinced that evolution is the best scientific explanation we have for biological diversity, and I'm convinced on the basis of the evidence. So thank you for correcting me.
Well, anytime. And if Theodore said that nothing in biology makes sense outside of evolution, I'm sorry. I guess he'd have to define what he means by evolution. I agree that variations happen within the kind, and they're sometimes pretty bizarre variations, like Chihuahuas and Great Danes. But I would say all we've ever observed is these variations are limited to the same kind. And if you want to believe that makes grass related to humans, you can, but that's not science. You said if you changed your religion, it would have no effect at all. Herman, what would happen if you changed to be a young earth creationist tonight? Would that affect your, would they fire you where you work?
Well, let me put it this way. Unlike AIG or ICR, I don't have an employment contract that as a condition of my employment requires me to either reject or accept any idea in science. So I don't know what they would do, but I have, unlike those people with those institutions, I don't have a contract that holds me to believe in certain scientific principles and reject others.
I have a question for Kent. It's kind of related to this. Kent, is it your position that you can't be a true Christian and follow the model that Dr. Mays is talking about?
Oh, I didn't say that. No, I think a lot of true, honest, genuine Christians are deceived, just like he is deceived, into believing something that they've been taught. I think in the Soviet Union 20 years ago, you'd have a real hard time finding a teacher in any school that didn't believe in communism. I think in North Korea right now today, you'd have a hard time finding anybody who didn't love their dictator. I think that the fact that most scientists today and most biology teachers in public universities believe in evolution does not make it true. It just makes it majority opinion, or it means they're afraid of being silenced.
That's not it.
It's not it. Okay.
It's a consensus position, and there's a big difference.
Go in tomorrow and tell your boss you have changed your mind. Just test it. Boss, I've become a young earth creationist. I think evolution is limited where the animals bring the same kind. I think our textbooks are wrong. We're telling them humans and grass are related. I don't believe that's true anymore.
Well, Ken, I would actually be happy to do that.
Please do. Yeah, I want to see what happens.
I would be happy to do that if you actually took me up on the opportunity to give me a convincing scientific reason to be a young earth creationist, but you haven't really answered any of my questions. So
okay. You
or anybody else hasn't convinced me to go into my boss and tell him that I'm a young earth creationist because you haven't given any evidence of these claims at all. So I'm sorry, but I'm not going to do that any more than I would walk into my boss's office tomorrow and tell him I believe the earth is flat. Because also there's no evidence.
I agree. Well, Kansas is pretty flat. That's about the only place. And Texas, part of Texas. But no, the earth is round and it spins. I think the flat earth idea is stupid, but that's what some people believe. Okay, they can believe what they want. Now, we are way over time and I got folks waiting on me, but let's do this again. I think what you need, Herman, is to watch my whole video series. Maybe that would get you straightened out.
How much are they, Kent?
I'll send you one for free. Send me an address. I'll send you one for free.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Hey, better yet, would you put it in your class and encourage your students to watch it? And call me with questions.
No, I'm not too.
Why not? Are you an educator or an indoctrinator?
I'm an educator.
Well, then put my series in there.
I'll tell you why I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to do it for the same reason I'm not going to put literature about the earth being flat or vaccines causing autism, things like that, because there's no evidence for it. And in science, the things we teach in the classroom are things that are supported by the evidence,
and
things that are a consensus position that have convinced people with expertise based on the evidence that this is the best explanation we have. And you haven't convinced me of that. So until you do, it doesn't go in the classroom. Now, if you come up with an idea tomorrow that you can test neutral variation, a way that you can use neutral variation to test your model of creation, then I'm all ears. But you haven't done that.
Well, tell you what, come to Lenox, Alabama, southern Alabama, north of Pensacola, a little bitty town of 40 people.
Yeah, I lived in Auburn.
We're just 2 miles off of I-65. I'll take you to lunch and give you a tour of our place and show you what we teach here, and we can try to get you straightened out. Now, Herman, last question. I got to go. Are you content to die someday with your beliefs and face, if there is a creator, what's going to happen to you when you stand before him? That will happen. You know,
the only way I can respond to that is through a biblical reference. And I'm sorry, I don't have the memory for Bible verses that you have, but in Ecclesiastes, that the verse where the dead know nothing. And I believe that. And I also believe in the book of Ecclesiastes, which says we should love our family and do good work and all that, because at the end of the day, there is nothing left. And I'm happy with that. I'm fine.
Okay.
I don't need anything else other than the life that I've been given.
And I know we got to wrap this up. So I want to thank both you gentlemen. Again, both you guys have given us more than enough time to talk about these topics. I think there's
a very spirited
debate. I know we're going to have to do some editing on this because of technical difficulties. So please bear with us. It's not to try to eliminate any of the conversation. Okay. So, but Dr. Mays,
thank you guys.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Kent,
thank you.
Once again, thank you very much.